Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.
It's September. That means a new school year for many students. But this year, it means classes are beginning at colleges across the country with the first class of enrollees after the Supreme Court struck down affirmative action. That means race cannot be considered as a factor in admissions. And we are seeing the results of that decision. Colleges, particularly Ivy League schools, are reporting across the board just about a reduction in the number of Black and Latino students in their incoming classes. This is an issue, of course. I feel personally connected to this because even Boston University, I'm a proud Terrier, my alma mater, has fewer Black students. And it made me think when I was there, I remember so many times I was the only Black person in the classroom as it was. So that means more people will have that experience if they get there at all. So what's the solution? I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and this is Justice by Design. This is where we find solutions to some of the pressing problems we have, like equal access to higher education. And to discuss that with me, I am so thrilled to have Jinhee Lee of the Legal Defense Fund at the NAACP. Jinhee, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. This is such an important topic, and I'm looking forward to this conversation.
So, Jinhee, before we get started, I want you to introduce yourself a little bit so our listeners know your work in this space.
So I am the Director of Strategic Initiatives at the Legal Defense Fund, and we actually represented 25 Harvard student and alumni organizations in the Students for Fair Admission versus Harvard case, the case that went to the Supreme Court. And we represented these students and alumni from the very beginning at trial and stuck with them all the way through the court process for years until it reached the Supreme Court. And I can tell you that the decision was devastating for them because they knew and experienced firsthand how important racial diversity is and was to their educational experience. And again, this was a multiracial group of student and alumni organizations representing all kinds of racial and ethnic backgrounds and religious backgrounds and so forth. And it was wonderful working with them because you really got to see firsthand why it's so important to be among, you know, diverse peoples, and especially in an educational setting. But they are still very much committed to ensuring that universities like Harvard do all they can to ensure diversity despite the Supreme Court decision.
So speaking of Harvard, they are among the schools that reported a decrease, particularly in Black and Latino students in their incoming class. Before that, MIT also reported that fewer Black and Latino students were a part of their incoming class. But the data, it's important to note that the data is complex. For example, at MIT, there was an increase in the number of Asian American students and not a big increase in the number of white students, for example. But on the other hand, if you look at the statistics at Yale, there were fewer Asian students and many more white students in their incoming class. What does this variety of data tell you?
Well, I think that, one, it's difficult to really discern ultimate conclusions because this was the first year without having the benefit of affirmative action in admissions. It was also a year when the FAFSA, the financial aid application that students had to complete, was a fiasco, essentially, and really caused wreaked havoc for many, many families, especially families that need financial aid, and that obviously disproportionately affects families of color. And we're still trying to figure out, you know, what these numbers means. And I think another factor that people should consider is that we are still, you know, kind of getting out of the pandemic. So many students, you know, during the pandemic, that was, you know, perhaps a reason to postpone college. You know, now we're seeing the number of applications have increased exponentially. So, you know, it's going to take some time to really discern what are definitive trends. But I think ultimately, you know, some important takeaways is that an important tool for colleges and universities to ensure or try to facilitate having a diverse class has been taken away. And that has had an impact on some universities. And also, I think it demonstrates that different universities have made different efforts to compensate for that, you know, through lawful means. And this is a message that we at the Legal Defense Fund really wanted to spread to everyone, is that despite these affirmative action decision, the universities still have an obligation to try to create as much of a diverse class as possible and to really identify barriers to admission, unfair barriers to admission for many students of color that continue to exist. Because we all understand that the admissions process is not fair.
Yeah.
And that's the default. And they need to be diligent in trying to identify where those barriers are and trying to remedy those. And there are so many ways to be able to do that. And, you know, some universities have been doing a better job of that than others.
Okay. I do want to get to, because this is a solutions focused podcast.
Yes.
I do want to get to the things that can be done to overcome those barriers or remove those barriers. But first, I want to take a couple steps back as to where we've been, because that decision by the U.S. Supreme Court was brought on the basis that these affirmative action programs actually are discriminatory on the basis of race because they discriminated against Asian American students. Now, granted, they were the lawsuit was actually brought by an organization led by Ed Blum who was not an Asian American student and who has been assailing such policies as affirmative action and DEI for a very long time. But I want you to answer, because there's already a piece out by the Federalist Society saying, aha, the incoming class of Harvard proves that Asian American students were discriminated against. What do you say to that argument?
Well, first, I think it's really important for everyone to understand that in the Supreme Court decision in the Harvard case, the Supreme Court did not say that the affirmative action program discriminated against Asian Americans. That was a specific claim that Students for Fair Admission made. They litigated that throughout the courts. Every single court, the trial court, the First Circuit Court of Appeals, and the U.S. Supreme Court rejected that claim. So to say that it is intentionally discriminatory against Asian Americans has not been proven, and in fact has been dismissed. And I think this is really important to know, because even, you know, we at the Legal Defense Fund take very seriously any allegation of intentional discrimination against any person of color.
Right.
And so we don't dismiss that, you know, readily, but this is a claim that, you know, there was SFFA had every opportunity to get as much evidence and to make their case that there was discrimination against Asian Americans, and they didn't make it. And so it's one thing when you make these claims in the media, and it's another when you're making it in a court of law where you actually have to back up the claims that you're making.
Right.
And I think it's really worth noting that, for example, the clients that we had at the Legal Defense Fund, when I mentioned these student and alumni organizations, they included every major Asian American student and alumni organization that was part of this amici group, and amici meaning friend of the court, this, you know, just being able to provide information to the court in support of affirmative action. It was something like 11 Asian American student organizations, and then the one major Asian American alumni organization. And there were also Asian American students and alumni who testified at trial in support of affirmative action because they understood that they personally benefited from that, either through their admissions process or because of the diversity that they experienced in their education. And the plaintiffs, SFFA, had every opportunity to present their own witnesses, but did not present a single, not one single Asian American testified on their behalf at trial.
Right.
And SFFA could not point to one specific Asian American who was discriminated against in Harvard's admissions process. Yeah. So, you know, I think it's really important for people to understand that there is a difference between someone just making some sort of allegation or claim without any backup, you know, in the media or, you know, wherever they are in public discourse, and then, you know, in a court of law where you actually have to back up what you're saying.
Yeah. So let's get to what the barriers are that remain after this decision so that we can identify them and then talk about the ways to break them down. What are some of the barriers for students, particularly those from underrepresented groups, to get into college?
I think that it is widely acknowledged that we have a broken public educational system at the K-12 level. It's really shocking that our school system, our public school system, is more racially segregated now than it was in the 1980s. And this is, you know, and it's not, and the result of having racially segregated schools is that the schools that are predominantly Black and Latino and Indigenous and providing, educational services to underserved communities are going to have fewer resources, which means they're going to have fewer opportunities. Now, what are the resources we're talking about? We're talking about advanced placement courses, calculus, we're talking about science fairs, internship opportunities, programs, after school, you know, activities, sports, extracurricular activities. These are the things that students rely on their application to really stand out among, you know, the many, many qualified students that are applying, especially to the competitive schools. So from the very beginning, you know, some students just have more opportunities than other that has nothing to do with their intelligence or their potential or their capabilities, and had everything to do with where they're growing up and their families, you know, financial circumstances. And that, unfortunately, that disparity falls along racial lines. Yes. It's not to say that, you know, everyone who has these opportunities are a particular race. Of course not. You know, there's examples and so forth. But there are clear racial lines as to, you know, who predominantly has these opportunities and who don't. And that is why we see these disparities in admissions rates. Because I think what people need to understand is that the alternative, if you don't believe that, and that's, you know, it's fact, this is evidence, if you don't believe that, what you are saying is that some students are less deserving and less intelligent to go to some of these schools.
Yeah.
And to say that determination of intelligence and capability kind of falls along racial lines is really troubling when not too long ago we had a segregated school system that intentionally discriminated against the very, very, you know, the very racial groups that continue to be disadvantaged in our current educational system.
And this is such an important point, and it certainly reflects my experience. For example, you know, I jokingly call my parents the integrators because I'm the youngest of six kids. And what my parents did was they saw as neighborhoods change, they saw fewer resources in the public schools there. So they kept moving to different communities outside of Detroit to find a better school system to send their schools to, because they knew once schools, the more Black a community became, the less resources those schools were allocated, and the more trouble that we would have. By the time I came along, they didn't want to move anymore, so they were able to scrimp and save and send me to a private high school that was college preparatory. But it's the onus is often on parents. Not everybody has the wherewithal to do that. If they're in a school system that is lacking, that doesn't have the resources based on, and as you said, it is an analogy to the racial composition and segregation in America. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, even 70 years after Brown v. Board of Education, that is still the same way. So we're not talking about people getting a leg up, getting an advantage. It's literally evening the playing field so that everybody has a shot to go to Harvard or to go to their state university. You know, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. UNC was one of the plaintiffs in these one of the parties in this case, and they also have seen a dip in their diversity in this incoming class.
Yeah, absolutely. And can I just also add, though, it's not even because there is the economic disparity and the lack of resources, mm-hmm. but one of our clients, one of the students, Black students who testified at the Harvard trial, was actually from an affluent family and had resources. But even then, her mother had to advocate for her to be in the gifted and talented program.
Yeah.
Even though she's passed all the tests, she demonstrated, but for whatever reason, her teacher did not select her to be in that program. So she had to have a mother to advocate for her, and not everyone, you know, is lucky enough to have a mother who maybe has the time or the ability to, you know, take time out of work to do that kind of advocacy. And then, you know, and then so many students like her, and this is, you know, her experience as well, went to, you know, a private school to get those resources, but she was one of a handful of Black students in her school. So she's at a disadvantage among her peers, her classmates, of being in a classroom where she, you know, is experiencing racial isolation. She was not invited to the prom, dealing with all of these emotional and, you know, these issues of being a teenager that the other students did not have to worry about in terms of, you know, your racial identity and feeling like you're different and that you don't belong, and having to overcome that in order to have the academic excellence and the criteria in order to be competitive in some of these selective universities. And so
of that story reflects my experience.
I'm sure, like, because when you were talking about, you know, your own experience, I mean, it's just, you hear this so many times.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about solutions. So how do we get past this? What way, without the ability to consider race, can school admissions officials ensure as best as they can that they have diverse student bodies, because that is, despite what the Supreme Court says, a compelling interest. It is in everybody's interest to have diversity in student bodies. So what can these administrators do?
Well, I think, first of all, there needs to be an explicit recognition that the K-12 educational system is not fair, and that when universities are receiving applications, these are not, you know, it's not as if all of these students had the same resources as we just talked about. So there needs to be some sort of allowance for that. You know, you can't just look at solely AP courses or calculus courses when you know that, you know, maybe over half of the schools that these students go to don't even offer those courses. So there has to be some sort of consideration of, you know, what were the resources available to the students, and how did they do given those resources? I think there's also been tremendous criticism of standardized testing, and this has been proven. There's evidence that the standardized tests that we rely on were created, you know, in the mid, 20th century, with an understanding that, white middle class, upper class students would be taking those. It was geared for that kind of student body taking those courses, and that there's really been a discriminatory effect on, for example, Black students taking those courses. So it's not indicative of people's ability when you compare those test scores. And, and it shouldn't be a cutthroat game that someone with a test score that's 50 points higher is somehow more deserving of getting into a university. And I think that's why many universities have, chosen not to rely on them. And then there's a move to go back to using them.
Yeah.
But that's always been a barrier. And then the idea, too, that universities can just sit back and just let the applications come to them is, I think, something that they need to revisit, that there needs to be some sort of affirmative outreach and recruitment strategy to really reach those students who are really capable, but maybe had not even dreamed of going to, a university like Harvard. Because yeah. The reality is that there are too few Black students, for example, who apply to these types of universities. And they should be getting more of these applications so that they can actually have more qualified students available in the whole admissions process. And another thing that I think often gets overlooked, because it's not necessarily a part of the admissions process, but it does affect the admissions process, and that is the experience of students of color when they are on campus. Because, high school students, when they're trying to pick what school they want to, they don't want to go to a school where they don't feel like they're going to belong. I mean, this is, colleges, we all know this, that that's a very big decision. And it's, it's definitely about academics, but it's also about the college experience. And so going to a university where you know that you're going to be experiencing that racial isolation, where you're not going to be feeling like you belong, that you're going to have challenges in addition to the academic challenges of colleges and universities, that's going to have an impact on students, high school students' decision to apply or even to accept an offer. And so, these are the things that, colleges and universities really need to be thinking seriously about is, are they attending to the needs of students of color, that they have on campus, and especially if they have very small numbers, that they really need to, they need to really show that they're committed to supporting these students and welcoming these students on their campus.
I just want to underscore that a little bit,
yes.
Because that is really important. And that was also an experience, when I went to, I have 2 degrees from BU, including a law school degree. And in my law school class of 400, there were 7 Black students in my law school class of 400. And I talked to people, including prospective students that did come, and they were like, I just don't want to go to Boston. And so I want to say, if you know that you are a world-class institution, but you're in a place that people may not feel comfortable, invite them, have a program that would bring them for the weekend, have them talk to people like me. I mean, it's a way to get past that perception. Because even members of my family, I'm from Detroit, and they're like, why are you going to Boston to school? It's so racist there. And if I'd listened to that, I wouldn't have had that opportunity. So that's such an important issue, particularly when you're talking to people in marginalized communities.
No, absolutely. And it also just show that you, and also that it's not just for show, it's not just to have a picture on their brochure, but that they're really committed to that. And at the end of the day, there's a benefit to that too, because if they're not attracting, students because of like their reputation, they're missing out on some really talented people. Like, it's just, if you think about a whole segment of the law student population that they're not even having a chance to have as part of their law school community, it's to their benefit actually to be attracting more students. And then I think, I don't know if this was your experience as well, but that commitment is also demonstrated in the diversity of faculty as well. Mm-hmm. This, you hear this all the time too, is, in universities where there may be only 1 or 2 Black professors and they take on the full responsibility of all things dealing with diversity issues and things like that, which is also unfair, and all the you know, kind of the stereotyping and tokenism that comes with only having a handful of, yeah, of professors as well as a handful of students, as opposed to recognizing, you know, the vast diversity that would happen if you had, you know, racially diverse professors who are all very different and, yeah, may have different interests and so forth. And so this, you know, not this assumption that just because of their race that they'll be doing XYZ or something like that. And I think that, right, also opens up people's students' ideas and understandings, and also for, you know, not just for students of color, but the other students too, that they see that, you know, the complexities and the rich diversity even within racial groups.
Yeah, that's really important. So before we run out of time, I know there's been a lot of attention paid to legacy admissions as well as sports scholarships. What do you think about those in the discussion about life after affirmative action?
I think that it's really important to really examine what is the impact of legacies and sports scholarships on students of color, and whether they create barriers or whether they create opportunities. And so I will say for sports, for example, in some ways it is an opportunity for many students of color who may not otherwise be able to access a college education. Although we also see in certain sports, like, you know, sports that are predominantly white, for example, or that require a lot of resources, that they are somehow able to more easily access admissions to some universities than others. And especially when those sports almost require some level of financial resources to have been competitive at the high school level. You know, for example, you know, rowing or tennis or things like that, where you really need to have like a personal coach and so forth. And right. So instead of just kind of thinking simply about sports scholarships, it's important to understand the full context of those scholarships and people's access to resources to be able to be competitive. And how does that play out in terms of barriers and opportunities? The same for legacies. You know, I think that there's been some concerns about legacies, you know, that for alumni of color, and whether, you know, like whether they should be able to benefit from legacies as white, you know, alumni had before. But I think in terms of legacies overall, one of the things that, you know, should be, you know, people should be thinking about is that, you know, the irony is that, you know, legacies are all dependent or is premised on the advantages of students applying because their parents, but then also their ancestors, had been alumni of that university. And when you go back through that ancestry, and this is certainly true in places like, for example, UNC, you know, some of those ancestors were attending these universities when they explicitly excluded Black students. So, you know, some students are benefiting, but this is actually an affirmative action that they've been receiving for many, many, many generations in terms of being able to benefit from, you know, a racially exclusionary, you know, policy that had existed not too long ago. So yeah. all of these policies are really complicated, but I think it's important to examine them as in, among all the other potential barriers that colleges and universities may have in their admissions process.
Jen Healy, this is an important conversation. Please come back and we can talk about this more as we get more data and as we see what universities are doing to try to break these barriers down.
Thank you for having me. This is such an important topic, and I would love to come back.
As you may have been able to tell, this is an issue that is very, very close to my heart. There are a lot of times, not just throughout my life as a student, but in my professional life, that I realize that I am where I am because I'm an exception, not the rule, because I made it against all odds, not just because I deserve to be there. And one of those times was when I was a reporter covering the U.S. Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court handed down its decision in Schuette, which upheld a constitutional amendment in Michigan that barred affirmative action. This is long before it was barred coast to coast. And Justice Sonia Sotomayor read from her dissent from the bench. And I will read some of what she said. She said, "Race matters. Race matters to a young man's view of society when he spends his teenage years watching others tense up as he passes, no matter the neighborhood where he grows up. Race matters to a young woman's sense of self when she states her hometown and then is pressed, 'No, where are you really from?' regardless of how many generations her family has been in the country. Race matters to a young person addressed by a stranger in a foreign language which he does not understand because only English was spoken in his home. Race matters because of the sights, the slights, the snickers, the silent judgments, that reinforce the most crippling of thoughts, 'I do not belong here.'" When she spoke those words from the bench, I sort of broke character as somebody who was there covering just the facts. It was the only time that I can remember that I actually shed tears in court as a decision was read in real time. Because I understand what's at stake, and I understood what was coming from that court and the impact that it would have to so many people just trying to get a shot at getting the education that is required to make it in this country. So I really hope that college administrators take this to heart, realize that ensuring everyone has access to education is a compelling interest, even if the Supreme Court says it's not, and that they do the work to ensuring that it is a just society for all, because justice is done by design. Thank you for joining me. Don't forget to follow me on YouTube. I have a YouTube channel that you can find, as well as wherever you get your podcasts. Follow me. Give us good reviews. That's how other people find us. And make sure you follow yourself so you never miss an episode of Justice by Design. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. See you next week.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.